From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, 250,000 years of history in an ice core. We talk with Paul Majewski, chief scientist with the Greenland Ice Sheet Project. They're able to pinpoint the start of the Industrial Revolution and the end of the Ice Age because ice traps atmospheric changes. Scientists hope the ice will also give them clues about global warming. Also, making the Joy Luck Club into a movie. Amy Tan's best-selling novel has made it to the screen. We talk with Amy Tan and screenwriter Ron Bass, who collaborated with her on the screenplay. And critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about two new movies, California and True Romance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Palestine Liberation Organization has formally recognized Israel. A close aide to PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat said he signed a document recognizing the Jewish state on behalf of his organization. The mutual recognition paves the way for the signing of an Israeli PLO agreement Monday in Washington. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more.
A special session of Israel's inner cabinet was convened to approve recognition of the PLO. The vote was unanimous. Culture Minister Shulamit Aloni.
For many years I was waiting for this moment, and it's a great thing.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin will initial the agreement tomorrow. The agreement is three letters. In one, from Arafat to Rabin, the PLO leader says the PLO recognizes the right of Israel to exist, rejects violence, and promises to change the Palestine National Covenant. In a second letter from Arafat to the Norwegian Foreign Minister, Arafat calls on the Palestinian people to end violence. In return, Rabin's letter says that Israel recognizes the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
President Clinton was in Cleveland today to promote his plan to streamline government programs. He chose a shopping center in Cleveland to illustrate how government can help communities by cutting red tape. The shopping center was built on land seized by the city for delinquent taxes. The city expedited the foreclosure process to allow the removal of abandoned buildings that were described as a blight on the community. The president said his new policies will consolidate federal grants to cities and give them more flexibility to operate similar programs. Police in Miami continue to hunt for a second suspect believed to be involved in yesterday's murder of a German tourist. The incident has left state officials worried about Florida's $30 billion a year tourism industry. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
The murder of German tourist Uwe Wilhelm Rockebron, South Florida's eighth murder of a foreign visitor in the last year, occurred despite the unprecedented series of steps that have been taken in recent months to protect area visitors. Miami Mayor Xavier Suarez has told a number of international news organizations that even with improved roadway signage and unmarked rental cars, it might take even more law enforcement efforts to make people feel safe. Within 24 hours of Rockebron's murder, police arrested one man who they say has confessed to being involved in the crime. He's being held without bond. A female companion is still being sought, and at one point today, police erroneously reported the woman was in custody. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
Stock prices were up slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up a fraction of a point to close at 3,589.5. This is NPR. A new study suggests that increased spending on education doesn't necessarily translate into improved results. The study was conducted for the American Legislative Exchange Council, a group of state lawmakers, most of whom are Republicans. The report said that school spending has risen by 47% since 1973, but student performance on standardized tests has risen modestly at best. The study also indicates that some of the best results are coming from some of the lowest spending states. New York's former chief judge will begin serving a prison sentence later this month. As Gene Dillard reports from Trenton, he's admitted to a campaign of terror against his former girlfriend.
Federal Judge Ann Thompson sentenced Saul Wachler to a 15-month jail term and $30,000 fine. He was also ordered to pay $30,000 to his ex-lover, Joyce Silverman, in restitution for the cost she incurred in hiring bodyguards during the time he harassed her and threatened to kidnap her daughter. Wachler's attorneys contended the former judge was suffering from emotional and mental problems, which made him act in an aberrant manner. U.S. Attorney Michael Chertoff disagreed.
We're not here, you know, replaying The Exorcist. He wasn't possessed by an evil spirit. He wasn't in the grip of forces beyond his control.
Judge Thompson characterized Wachler's actions as bizarre and said they were not expressions of love for his former paramour, but of anger, intimidation, and grotesque control. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
Germany's central bank cut two key interest rates today in what officials hope will start a chain reaction of easier credit and increased business throughout Europe. The Bundesbank cut its discount rate and its emergency lending rate by 0.5% each. Germany's neighbors have been appealing for it to cut interest rates for months, since Germany's high rates tend to draw off capital from investing in other countries. The central bank has been reluctant to cut rates for fear of higher inflation. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. The last place you're likely to see Paul Majewski is in a warm tropical climate. He's more attracted to the cold, the really cold. Paul Majewski is one of the few people who can rightly call themselves a glaciologist, and he spent many years doing research in remote places like Antarctica, the Himalayas, Greenland. He has found that ice is a veritable frozen library of information about past climate changes. By drilling into ice cores and analyzing ice samples, Majewski and his team have been able to gather a historical record of past ice ages, volcanic eruptions, warming trends, and more. Majewski just returned from 5 months in Greenland, where he directs the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. His team has been able to bore into the ice there and retrieve samples that go back 250,000 years. Greenland is a fertile site for this work because of the depth of the glaciers and the temperature. Even in the height of summer, it never goes above freezing. Majewski and his co-workers have a fairly complete laboratory in the ice in Greenland, and in spite of having to wear thick gloves, thermal boots, and plenty of layers, they can do a lot of sophisticated research on site. The drill they use is about 100 feet high and is housed in a 52-foot diameter dome.
If you can imagine it's sort of a corkscrew, and we basically screw it down into the ice, it collects a 5.2-inch diameter core, which is as long as 20 feet. And once we've filled the barrel up with approximately 20 feet of ice, we pull it back up to the surface. It's on a very, very long cable, and put it onto a horizontal position, and then extrude or push out the core. And at that point, we begin to make a lot of the preliminary measurements on the core.
How far down have you been able to drill? What's the farthest you've been able to go?
Well, we actually have the world record in terms of depth of ice, which is an important fact for us, because it also means, more importantly, that we have the oldest and longest record in the world. We were able to drill down. The exact depth in meters is 3053.44 meters. It's a little bit over 11,000 feet.
Okay, 11,000 feet, and how far back in time does that take you?
That 11,000 feet takes us back probably something close to 250,000 years. We have a great deal of confidence in being able to date the first 90 to 100,000 years of the record, because we actually see annual markers, which we've been able to count down as you would count tree rings down. When we get to the lower part of the core, approximately the lower 200 meters or about 650, 700 feet, much of the remaining 150,000 years is squashed down in that lower portion of the core. So it becomes a little bit harder to tell the exact age.
You have described these samples of ice as being like the Rosetta Stone. What kind of secrets are embedded in the ice?
Well, it's an amazing record. It's an potentially a very, very vivid, robust record of what our paleo environment has been. And we're able to, by measuring as many as 42 different parameters in any one sample, and doing this at very, very high resolution, great detail, and doing it continuously down the record, we're able to capture a great deal of information about what the atmosphere was comprised of, what the winds were like, what the temperatures were like. We can, for all purposes, draw a very, very vivid picture of the paleo environment.
Can you, though, generalize from the ice in Greenland to climatic conditions in more temperate climates or even in tropical climates?
The record in central Greenland is certainly telling us something about the atmosphere throughout a very, very large portion of the Arctic and probably throughout a great portion of the North Atlantic region. It does not necessarily tell us what was going on in the tropics, although with a very, very solid understanding of what went on in the Arctic, which tends to be, in terms of change in climate, a far more dynamic region, we could make some very, very good educated guesses about what the more temperate or tropical latitudes were doing. The way we get answers about the temperate and tropical latitudes is by collecting ice cores at very, very high elevations in Asia, which we can then calibrate or correlate back to the records in the polar regions like Greenland or Antarctica.
What then can you tell us about environmental conditions 250,000 years ago, looking either at the Arctic or looking at the North Atlantic region?
Perhaps the most remarkable thing that we found from our records is the fact that the last 10,000 years of Earth history, a time period which has seen the major growth in civilization, was a relatively mild and relatively stable period compared to the last 250,000 years. If we go back prior to our relatively warm time period, which is called an interglacial, a time between glacials, we find that the climate seems to, at least based on our ice core record, the climate in the North Atlantic and throughout the Arctic fluctuated very, very wildly. There would have been extremely strong winds that would have perhaps affected a region for several years and then suddenly stopped for a while. Temperature variations would have been very, very dramatic. In a word, it was a very, very tumultuous environment compared to the one that we live in today.
Do you know why there has been climatic stability in the last 10,000 years, though?
I'd say preliminarily it's because of the fact that over the last 10,000 years we have not had extensive ice cover over portions of North America and Europe. And because we haven't had that extensive ice cover, it means that the air masses which move over the northern hemisphere have not had large, white, slippery surfaces in which they can effectively pick up wind speed and also deviate in terms of their latitudinal position quite easily. So it's probably the presence of large ice sheets more than 10,000 years ago that created the instability. So, of course, the next question one asks oneself is why were the large ice sheets there prior to 10,000 or 11,000 years ago and not today? And perhaps the best good general answer is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun changes on a periodic basis. And when the Sun is relatively closer to the Earth in general terms, we have less likely conditions for glacier growth. And when the Sun is relatively far from the Earth, we have good conditions. And there are tens of thousands of year cycles which the Sun and Earth go through, changing their relative position.
I want to make sure I understand then the climatic changes or the instability that occurred more than 10,000 years ago. Do you see this as a result of the Earth's relationship to the Sun, or were there other things at work here on Earth?
There are a whole range of things that control climate. Perhaps one of the primary things is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun. It definitely sets the major stage for climate. It plunges the surface of the Earth into gradually cooler time periods or gradually warmer time periods. And it may very well explain the overall growth and decay of the very, very massive ice sheets that cover the northern hemisphere or large portions of the northern hemisphere. After that, however, there are a whole range of other things or factors which control climate. And they include things such as the greenhouse gases. Increases in greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, tend to trap heat at the surface of the Earth. Volcanic explosions give off both dust and also gases which tend to shield incoming radiation. There are a whole range of so-called forcing or climate forcing factors, and many of those we are actually able to measure in our ice core. So the remarkable thing about the ice core record is the fact that we not only have a detailed, vivid history of what the environment was, but we also were able to measure many of the things which can potentially cause the change in the climate.
What does a volcanic explosion look like in an ice core?
A volcanic explosion in an ice core is usually marked either by an ash layer. This is the particles that are thrown up by very explosive volcanoes, or by an increase in sulfuric acid because of the sulfur gases that are given off by the volcano. As of the last few decades, there's been an immense amount of interest in this, certainly recently because of Pinatubo, several years ago because of El Chichon. And we now know that it's primarily the gas, the sulfur gas, that's given off by these volcanoes that gets into the atmosphere, gets converted to sulfuric acid, and is very, very effective in shielding incoming radiation.
Can you see the start of the Industrial Revolution looking at the ice core?
Yes. That's an excellent question. We've been able to see very, very solid evidence for the onset of the Industrial Revolution using several different types of measurements. Perhaps the most precise of all of the measurements, again, is sulfuric acid. Volcanoes are not the only source of sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. It also comes from various biological organisms will give it off, particularly from the ocean, but also from the land. And as of about the last 100 years, in fact, beginning literally at the turn of the century, we see tremendous increases in sulfur dioxide measured in our core as sulfuric acid, which were produced by human activity, industrialization. And we not only see the start of this humanly produced pollution, but we can also see increases and decreases in the level of it, which mark very, very closely, or I should say parallel very, very closely, what we do know about emissions coming from factories, particularly coal-burning plants. And perhaps the most important thing is the fact that we not only see these oscillations in sulfuric acid in the Greenland ice core being produced by industry effectively turning up and turning down its coal burning, but we also see the effect of the Clean Air Act, which as of the early 1970s, in our particular record, shows that there was not the there was actually a leveling out of the pollution or the sulfuric acid that was contributed to the Greenland ice sheet from North American sources. So it's a very, very sensitive indicator, but it is only one of the indicators that we have of human activity.
We're going to take a very short break. My guest is Paul Majewski. He's a glaciologist and director of the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. We're talking about his research in Greenland, research looking at climate and climate change. He's also a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences and the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at the University of New Hampshire. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is glaciologist Paul Majewski. What is the evidence that you're seeing of global warming? And as you mentioned earlier, there's a debate, I guess, back and forth whether we're in a warming trend or not. What does the ice tell you?
I think that perhaps before thinking, or I should say discussing global warming, perhaps the best thing to do is to define what is actually implied by global warming. I think in general we think of the term global warming because it has warming in it as implying that temperatures will increase in the future largely because of the increased production of greenhouse gases, which are directly tied to population and combustion of fossil fuels. As it turns out, that may very well be the case. There are an awful lot of indications from a variety of records all over the world suggesting that temperatures are rising, but they don't necessarily rise everywhere the same amount, and they don't necessarily have to rise constantly. And I say that because we can very often counteract the effects of global warming or temperature increase by, for example, increasing the amount of sulfur dioxide as a pollutant in the atmosphere. So we have an interesting seesaw type of effect. The more we pollute the environment with acid rain, the more we may be able to cool off various portions of the environment. That's a poor trade-off. That's just the temperature part of global warming. I think the correct term is that we should be worrying about global change, which is not just a temperature increase in some parts of the world, but it will be, without a doubt, a dramatic change in climate in general. And I can even use the word dramatic because we know that there are both naturally occurring dramatic changes in climate and also humanly potentially humanly produced dramatic changes in climate. So that means that not only should we be looking at potential changes in temperature, but also wind speed, precipitation, dryness, humidity, on and on.
So from what you're learning from examining the ice core in Greenland, what concerns do you have about environmental conditions today?
Well, I can answer that best by giving you one small example of something that we found in central Greenland and then tracked to a much larger area. The Chernobyl event of the mid-1980s, that it was a disastrous event in terms of population and in terms of the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. From a scientific point of view, it provided us, although it was a very unfortunate event, it did provide us with a radioactive marker, which allowed us to trace the distribution of the Chernobyl fallout throughout the Arctic. And many scientists found evidence of this in the Greenland ice sheet, throughout all of the snowpacks in northern Scandinavia, on and on and on. But 18 months after the Chernobyl event, we were down at the South Pole in Antarctica, and we were digging a snow pit there, and when we came back to the laboratory, we analyzed that record, and we were able to find evidence of Chernobyl having traveled all the way to the South Pole. It was not at the radioactive levels were certainly not high enough to be of any danger whatsoever, but it did act as an excellent marker, and what it demonstrates is that even very, very small sources and relatively, in a global scale, the Chernobyl event was a very short event, and it came from a very, very small source, can make their way, in many cases, throughout the entire globe. So that tells us that the climate and the atmosphere is very, very sensitive, even to small changes.
From the ice records that you've been able to gather, can you make any predictions about the future?
One of the things we would dearly like to do is to be able to make a prediction about the future. And we can't do that right now, but I really do think that we will be able to make a very significant contribution to our understanding of future climate within a very short period of time. And I say that with some confidence because we have at our disposal now a time machine, the most detailed record of paleoclimate, paleoatmosphere, paleoenvironment that has ever been created. What we can do with this record and what we are doing right now, and it'll take us a couple more years because we need to analyze many more samples that we've recovered this year, is to understand as well as we can, make a giant step forward in our understanding of how climate works and whether or not there are cycles in climate, whether or not these cycles are simple or not. Once we understand the pattern of climate, we should be able to predict what natural climate would have done if it had not been for humans entering the scene in an industrial sense in the last 100 to 150 years.
Let me ask you about some of the conditions that you work in up in Greenland. I know you've worked in the Himalayas. You've also worked down in Antarctica. Is it a difficult transition for you to live both in New Hampshire, as you do, and to move into these very remote, distant regions of the world?
Perhaps the most honest way to answer that is to say yes. Whenever we make this sort of transition, the first few days are very difficult. It's it's wonderful to be home, but it's certainly strange to be back in a warm environment. If we've been working in Greenland, we come back from very cold temperatures, sometimes to be greeted by a heat wave, and even more strangely, to be greeted by darkness, which is something that you can is a great shock to your system. It's as big a shock coming back to darkness.
Do you change your diet at all when you're living completely in a cold environment?
Yes. In fact, diet is perhaps one of the great pleasures of being in these very, very cold environments, because we eat anything between 6 and 10,000 calories a day in order to keep warm. And that isn't necessarily because we're moving or traveling a lot. You burn up a great deal of energy just trying to stand in one place, which we sometimes have to do when we're processing the core.
Do you miss the night?
No, not at all. I miss a lot of things when I leave, but I don't miss the night. It's a great experience being able to live in a place that's light all the time. Many of us seem to have a lot more energy. Given my choice, I'd live in a place that was 24 hours of daylight all year round. It would mean a great deal of moving from the northern to the southern hemisphere, but I think it's certainly a preferable situation.
You work in very remote parts of the world. Is this dangerous work that you do?
It certainly is work that, in terms of danger, it's work that one has to take very, very seriously. I've been doing this work for 25 years, and I've led a great number of expeditions, and safety is the most important thing that that we think about. Number one is safety, and number two is making sure that that the people involved in these programs are doing well emotionally. The science is very, very important, but it follows right on track with those first two.
Have you had some close calls?
Certainly everybody in this sort of business has experienced very, very serious storms. We've been in storms in the Antarctic in our tents that are over 100 miles per hour, and you always feel as if you're on the edge when you're in a little piece of canvas with some metal poles, experiencing the equivalent of a freight train coming by every now and then for several days. Sometimes the snowstorms are extremely intense. There are whiteout conditions when you literally can't see your finger 3 inches away from your eyes. There are, in some areas, the danger of avalanche and crevasses. So there are times when suddenly you feel very unsure of the situation. But that's why you surround yourself with a good team of people. And usually what happens is if one person begins to feel that way, the others don't feel that way, at least temporarily. And as a group, you keep yourselves nice and calm.
You've been able to look back some 250,000 years or so. Do you have fantasies about a favorite year?
Actually, in a way, yes. I'm particularly interested in being able to pick some interesting time periods. For example, the sinking of the Spanish Armada in the early 1500s was a major turning point in the wars between the Spanish and the British. And the sinking occurred, I believe, during a time when the Spanish were about to attack the British and they were caught in a terrible storm. It would be very, very interesting to find out, to document that storm in our ice core, which I think we can do, and then find out, was this a time period when there were many, many storms, or was it simply a freak accident that the Spanish were caught in and it effectively changed history? There are many interesting associations between dramatic changes in history and dramatic changes in climate.
Thank you very much for talking to us today and telling us about your work. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Paul Majewski is director of the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. A cross-generational story about Asian mothers and daughters was the subject of the bestseller, The Joy Luck Club. Now it's a new film. Coming up, we talk with Amy Tan, who wrote the novel, and with screenwriter Ron Bass, who collaborated with her on the screenplay. And critic Kevin Whitehead, who's subbing for Stephen Schiff, reviews two new movies about poor young couples heading west, California and True Romance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The Israeli cabinet today gave Prime Minister Rabin permission to sign an agreement recognizing the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Later in Tunis, the PLO officially recognized the State of Israel. The agreement was signed by PLO leader Yasser Arafat at the end of a meeting of the organization's ruling executive body. Jackie Rowland reports.
The meeting of the PLO leadership was long and stormy. Yasser Arafat came under fire from senior officials for the way the recognition deal was brokered. They are angry that Arafat kept them in the dark about the secret talks with the Israelis. Despite strong opposition from his colleagues, the PLO leader managed to push the recognition deal through the executive committee. The agreement includes an undertaking by the PLO to scrap parts of its charter which call for the destruction of Israel. In response to Israeli demands for an end to the Intifada in the occupied territories, the PLO called on Palestinians to work for reconstruction and avoid violence. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
President Clinton says he's pleased with the news that the PLO and Israel will recognize each other. Mr. Clinton is reportedly ready to resume talks with the PLO if several conditions are met, including renouncing terrorism. Federal health officials estimate physical inactivity costs the nation almost $6 billion a year in medical care and lost productivity due to heart disease. They're urging new efforts to promote exercise. NPR's David Barron reports.
About 60% of American adults don't engage in regular physical activity. Studies have found that lack of exercise accounts for more deaths from heart disease than does smoking, obesity, or high blood pressure. In a new report, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urges public health officials, employers, and schools to spend more time and money promoting physical activity. Such efforts, the CDC contends, should more than pay for themselves in reduced health care costs. The report says exercise programs should especially target women, the elderly, and the poor, populations least likely to exercise regularly. The CDC says if just half of Americans currently leading sedentary lives were to take a brisk walk several times a week, some 20,000 heart disease deaths could be prevented each year. I'm David Barron in Washington.
The Senate today tried to set goals for U.S. troops in Somalia. West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd wants the U.S. to pull out unless Congress approves specific objectives for the operation. Most senators said today American forces should remain, but their mission needs to be clear. While the Senate deliberated, a battle broke out between Somali militia and UN peacekeepers in Mogadishu. One Pakistani soldier was killed and five Pakistanis and three Americans wounded. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained half a point to close at 3589.49. This is NPR. President Clinton signed an order today to make it easier for states and cities to get federal money. In Cleveland, the president announced the creation of a community enterprise board at the cabinet level. Vice President Al Gore will head the board, which will cut red tape in federal funding applications. State and local governments now complain of excessive regulations that make it difficult to apply for federal grants. A Detroit judge has ordered Dr. Jack Kevorkian to stand trial for allegedly violating a new Michigan law barring assisted suicide. Don Gagne reports.
On August 4th, Dr. Kevorkian was present for the suicide of 30-year-old Thomas Hyde, a Detroit-area man suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. Kevorkian later said that he supplied the canister of carbon monoxide and the gas mask Hyde used in taking his own life. Prosecutors saw the doctor's remarks as a direct challenge to a Michigan law which makes it a felony to help someone commit suicide. At the preliminary hearing today, Kevorkian's attorney argued that the law is unconstitutional, saying that a terminally ill person has a right to die. Judge Willie Lipscomb said he sympathized with the suffering people who seek Dr. Kevorkian's help, but he added that Michigan's law was properly written and that there is enough evidence to warrant a criminal trial. A conviction could bring a penalty of up to 4 years in prison. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The Clinton cabinet is getting ready to promote the North American Free Trade Agreement on Capitol Hill and around the country. The secretaries of Treasury, State and Commerce, and the U.S. Trade Representative will testify before Congress next week. They'll then fan out across the country to explain the treaty to business groups and others. Next, U.S. ambassadors to Latin countries will conduct a similar tour of major U.S. cities. Defense Secretary Les Aspin today confirmed that in the mid-1980s, the U.S. developed a secret program to deceive the Soviet Union about the progress of the Strategic Defense Initiative. Aspin said the program was never used. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Amy Tan's best-selling novel, The Joy Luck Club, has just been made into a movie directed by Wayne Wang. Tan co-wrote the screenplay with screenwriter Ronald Bass. Amy Tan had been a successful business writer before she turned to fiction. The Joy Luck Club reflected her own family's Chinese immigrant experience. Her parents came to the States in the 40s. Tan and her two brothers were born here. The book was about the tension between mother and daughter and about the difficulties of immigrant families living between cultures. Tan followed her first novel with The Kitchen God's Wife, based on her mother's stories of life in pre-communist China. While The Joy Luck Club is Amy Tan's first screenplay, her collaborator Ron Bass wrote the screenplay for Rain Man, for which he received an Academy Award. His other credits include Sleeping with the Enemy, Gardens of Stone, Black Widow. Amy Tan told me when she wrote The Joy Luck Club, she could never imagine it as a movie.
I think if I had imagined it, I would have been blocked from writing it, because so much of the book had to do with difficulties or discomforts in my life that I couldn't face, that I couldn't even talk about except through stories. So the idea that people would be seeing these as images on the screen would have terrified me.
As a writer, do you see your characters? Do you see the story?
I am a very visual writer. I write through, one of the things that motivates my stories are images. But I don't see my characters fully because I am the character as I write. My stories are written in the first person. And I can see my shoes. I can see clothes that I have on, but I can't always see my face. And so it's fascinating to see an actual character on the screen who is wholly realized in that way.
I assume you see the tips of your fingers too, right?
Yes, the tips of my fingers. Well, I actually use looking down at shoes as a way to change scenes as I write fiction. If I want to go someplace, I look down at my shoes and I start walking. And when I look up, I'm in that place. And I can look to the right and look to the left, look straight ahead. And I describe what I see. And I realize later on that it's very similar to movie making because you do what's called setups for each scene, those different audience perspectives.
This is a novel you wrote several years ago, and many novelists will say once a story is done, they really have completed that story,
Open,
and they're on to the next novel,
yes,
or even the one after that.
You don't want to repeat yourself.
Well, yeah. What's it like to go back and revisit these characters, revisit the story in such an important way and productive kind of way?
Well, I wanted to change everything. I was the one who said, well, let's make this different, you know. And they were the ones that were much more protective. But because I had not revisited the Joy Luck Club for such a long time, there were many things that I was learning and discovering. Wayne and Ron would say, this is a woman who's suffering from a lack of self-esteem, and it's come about this way. And I thought, really? You know, and I'd look at it and I'd say, well, here I'm getting a different take on something I'd written. I almost ended up, I did many times, felt as though they knew the book better than I did. And it was amazing, you know, you write something so unconsciously and then people come back and tell you what you've written.
I'm speaking with Ron Bass and Amy Tan, and they are the co-screenwriters for the new movie version of Amy Tan's novel. The movie is called The Joy Luck Club. Ron Bass, I'm curious. You've certainly worked on other films, and I don't know how many films you've seen that really have major characters played by women. Is it any different when it's a largely female cast?
Well, every film is always different. This is a film that has no movie stars.
More an ensemble.
It's completely an ensemble. The memory that I have that comes to my mind as you're talking is the first day of rehearsal when Amy and Wayne and I sat at the top of the table and I said to the eight women, many of whom had never met each other before, we're going to just start with a cold reading. Let me talk a little bit about who these people are in their hearts. And I talked a little bit and Wayne and Amy said some things. And they started to read the script through for the first time just cold. And when they got to the beauty shop scene, one actress after another started to cry. And there was one box of Kleenex on the table. And for the next 2 hours, these women passed that box of Kleenex to each other as they broke each other up with their scenes. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that, it was a sorority. I mean, we all looked at each other and we all knew that we were coming to the day where we now are.
Did you feel outsided at all because you're not Asian American?
Not at all. Not at all. I thought it was great. I was being allowed into a club that I didn't deserve to be in, that I never otherwise could have gotten into. And, we were just at the Telluride Festival, and Amy and all the actresses, all the young ones and a couple of the mothers were all buying clothes and trying on hats and dresses. And I got to be the guy sitting there watching them try all this stuff on, and I feel like a father with all of my kids. It was fantastic.
Some of this was shot in China. How difficult was it to work there? And I know that you were over there as well.
Yeah, it was arduous, but it was fascinating. The fascination, of course, was here. These stories some of them had been inspired in China, and there we were back in this place, Guilin, recreating the war. But it also rained every day, and it was freezing cold, and we had to endure a lot of things out of our control. Because, you know, when you're in China, you start to believe in fate and the gods and luck. You really want to believe in luck, and you have to believe in each other.
Is that because the culture is so strong when you're there?
I mean, it's so strong, but what's handed to you on a plate is what you get, and you can't often change that yourself. So you have to change your attitude about life in general. We had a lot of riots that went on in different locations. And by riots, I mean fist fights among hundreds of people or people who had misunderstood the nature of our shooting in China or wanted more money or something, and disagreements would break out. But the scenery is so spectacular, and the feeling that you get of being there. I have to just mention one. There was so much serendipity in finding locations, but also finding extras. There was a man who wanted to be an extra. When they told him what the scene was about a mother who had to leave twin babies behind during the war as the Japanese came and invaded Guilin, he broke into tears and started to sob. And he said, "My wife and I left two twin girls, 4 years old, on the road in Guilin, leaving when the Japanese came, and we never found them again." I mean, there was those sorts of amazing coincidences.
Let me ask you then, you wrote this book several years ago, and it's been passed through many hands, and you just told us, you know, a very powerful kind of story. How do you rethink the story that you wrote so, you know, several years ago? Is it a completely new life for you now?
It has a new life. It's a different from the book in a certain way, but yet the same as the book emotionally. I think people who've seen the movie feel that way, that it is very faithful in that way, but there's something new that's added. Just as in life, when you know somebody as a friend or as a mother, it's the same person, but maybe you see them in another situation, and it's very consistent with their character, but it's different, and you feel it differently. That's how I feel.
I'm speaking with Ron Bass and Amy Tan, and they collaborated on the screenplay for the new movie, The Joy Luck Club, written, of course, based on the novel by Amy Tan. Amy Tan's other novel called The Kitchen God's Wife, and she wrote a book for children called
The Moon Lady.
The Moon Lady. Yes. And Ronald Bass has written other screenplays, including the screenplay for Rain Man, for which he received an Academy Award. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Amy Tan and Ronald Bass, and they have collaborated on the screenplay for the new movie, The Joy Luck Club. Let me talk with each of you about your own individual lives. We've spent some time talking together about your work together. Ron Bass, when did you start writing?
The short answer is I started writing when I was 6 years old, and I had been sick in bed when I was a child and taught myself to read, and Dostoevsky and Faulkner and Fitzgerald were my heroes when I was very young.
How young?
Oh.
When were you reading Dostoevsky?
That might have been 12 or 13, maybe really? Some of the others when I was 9 or 10. And what I wanted to be was a novelist. I never thought about writing for screen. That was not even writing to me.
How long were you in bed?
Well, from age 3 completely till age 7 and then largely till about age 11.
How do you keep a child in bed all those years?
It's easy when he's sick enough.
You were that sick?
I was pretty sick for a lot of the time. And my folks were very worried. And I lived a very insulated life, and I lived in my imagination. And friends of mine, Spielberg, other people, tell me that that's why you are a writer, because you grew up that way. So I had written this little short anecdote was that I had written a novel when I was a teenager, and it's what I'd wanted to do. But when I went to college, I went to UCLA for 6 months before I could go to Stanford, and I fell in love with my English teacher, who was this beautiful 33-year-old woman from Columbia University. And I was the brightest kid she had, but I was this little tiny kid because my illness had kept me very small and looking very young. And I showed her the novel that I'd never shown anyone, and she thought it was wonderful writing, but when I said, "Can I get it published?" she said, "Oh, no, this is a personal fantasy of yours." So I went home and I burned the only copy of it ever, and decided that it was foolish to think that I could be something as wonderful as a writer. I had to use my IQ and my ability to work hard to do something practical, something that could earn a living, and eventually became a lawyer. I was a lawyer for 17 years.
Did you enjoy the law? Was there something...
Law was wonderful. It was something that I enjoyed and I was very good at, but it wasn't anything like writing.
Writing
is like living.
Lawyering is not like living.
Lawyering is like a job, and writing is like getting paid to live, to examine your life, to examine your heart, to examine the people around you, to consider what it is we're all doing here in every possible delicious variation all day long, every day, 18 hours a day, and then they pay you for doing that, and they say nice things about you. It's unfair.
What did you like about the law?
I'm a combative guy. I love to argue. I love to think quick. I wasn't a real lawyer. I was an entertainment lawyer.
Yeah, what's the difference?
Well, for like 12, I never was in a courtroom ever. For 12 or 14 hours a day, there'd be a phone with four or five different lights always lit, and I'd punch one button, and I'd be in the Goldie Hawn negotiation, and I'd punch another button. I was in the Jane Fonda negotiation, and you had to be in the middle of all these things very, very quickly. Now, as a screenwriter, I write 7 or 8 scripts a year, and I always have 8 or 10 things going at different stages, and people wonder how I keep them straight. But 17 years of negotiating as a lawyer in that way makes it easy to keep things straight.
I know for you, Amy Tan, the success of the Joy Luck Club made it difficult to write the second novel, The Kitchen God's Wife, and you wrote about the kind of angst and paralysis you felt, and even some of the psychosomatic symptoms that happened. What do you think was preventing you from writing, or what were some of the fears that you had?
Expectations. I had to deal with that from my mother, but now I had to deal with it from a million mothers, it seemed to me. I think as a writer, I'm always afraid that I'm going to fail in the next one, or that maybe anything that I had as a writer has been used up. It's no longer going to be there. And even if I didn't have the expectations of other people out there, I would have that expectation of myself. And so I start to grit my teeth and break them, you know, with pure anxiety over what will I do next, until I can finally find that space again and a balance, a sense of balance. It reminds me why I write. And I write to discover something about myself and to give something, you know, to my mother or to whomever I'm dedicating this book to. And then it makes it all right again.
Let me ask you something, Amy Tan, about the novels that you've written, The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife. Do you feel any more assimilated, if you know what I mean, having written those stories? And certainly those stories are based in part on stories of, yeah, of your mother and grandmother. And I know that as a young person growing up in this country, that you were, like many hyphenated people, yeah, caught between, yeah, cultures.
Yeah. It's funny you should ask that, because I really did, now that I think about it, I felt more assimilated writing that book. I felt more assimilated with my Chinese culture, the one that I had chosen to reject. I had been so adamant in proving that I was an American that I didn't want to know anything about my past, my family, what my mother had been through. And in that way, I could get that. It was not a matter of reclaiming it, because I had never claimed it. It was a matter of finding it, discovering it, that it was there all along in some form within me, because I had been raised by my parents. And it was a way of reclaiming it for my mother. Of taking it and this new concept that she taught me, which is that you can change the past. You can turn something that was purely pain and sorrow into something that's discovery and strength. And you can pass it on.
So do you feel, as an adult, then more Chinese-American, more equally Chinese and American?
I feel that now that a great sense of comfort in knowing that I don't have to decide one way or the other what I am, that this question of how much of me is Chinese versus American is a question that is very, very interesting, and I will have it all my life, because the answer to that changes from moment to moment, and it's wonderful.
Well, I thank you both very much for joining us and talking about your work together.
Thank you.
Amy Tan and Ron Bass co-wrote the screenplay for Tan's novel, The Joy Luck Club, which is now a new movie. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about some of the stories on All Things Considered. Linda, what news will you have from the Middle East?
Marty, we have a number of reports. Israel has cleared the way for a peace agreement by moving to recognize the PLO. We'll hear from Linda Gradstein in Israel and have a report from Tunis. And Robert Siegel is in Israel. He will be reporting from the divided village of Bataa. We also have a number of interviews in the show tonight. Mac McClarty, the president's chief of staff and one of his oldest friends. Carl Hyacin, who has written a new novel called Striptease, talks about that. And we'll also hear from the director of the Christian Coalition about new aims and goals for his organization.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the new movies California and True Romance, poor young couples from the Rust Belt head out to California a step ahead of the good or bad guys who pursue them. Subbing film critic Kevin Whitehead says one film aims to be deep and comes out dumb. The other is cheerfully stupid and fun to watch.
In the movie California, artsy young Brian and Carrie, who dress in black and are way too hip for Pittsburgh, are heading west to visit the haunts of America's favorite mass murderers and serial killers. They're working on a picture book. To share expenses, they take along two writers, one of whom, unluckily, is a serial killer on the lam. He's a redneck with an IQ of 7, the portentous name Early Grace, a perpetual squint that probably comes from staring into the sun, and a girlfriend who's not nearly as bright as him. This couple is played by Brad Pitt and Juliette Lewis with all the showy condescension Hollywood stars can muster. Not that the script gives them much choice.
Early?
Yeah.
Will you tell me more about California?
Yeah, I guess so. Let's see. One thing, people think faster out there on account of all that warm weather. Cold weather make people stupid. That's a fact.
I guess that explains why there's so many stupid people around here.
It sure does. You know what else?
What?
Never have to buy no fruit on account it's all on the trees everywhere you turn. And they ain't got no speed limits. I hear your first month's rent is free, state law. So I'm thinking until we get settled, we'll just move around from month to month. How'd that be with you, Mama?
The joke in California is that Brian, played by David Duchovny, prattles on about how serial killers live in the place between dreams and reality, while Early is very down to earth. He just kills because he's bored, ticked off, or low on cash. If California has a message, it's that serial killers are as individual as you and me. But since the people who made the film know as little about poor folk and sociopaths as Brian does, it's all pretty thin and schematic. There's barely anyone in this movie. All the secondary characters are either murder victims or lucky survivors. And since the four principals are tiresome, you don't much care who lives or dies. If California has no one in it, Tony Scott's film True Romance has everybody. Christopher Walken as a mafia don, Gary Oldman as a white guy who thinks he's black, Dennis Hopper, Bronson Pinchot, Unforgiven's Anna Thompson and Saul Rubinek, and Brad Pitt as a zonked out hippie. When it comes to portraying stereotypes, this guy's a one-man village people. Our bottom-feeding young couple this trip are trying to sell some stolen mob cocaine in Hollywood. Christian Slater is Clarence, who talks to Elvis in bathrooms, and the amazing Patricia Arquette is Alabama, who's from Florida. With one short conversation when they meet, they become more real than California's trailer trash ever get.
What are your turn-ons?
Mickey Rourke. Man, I can appreciate the finer things in life, like sugar. Elvis's voice. Kung Fu, pot.
Turn-offs?
Turn-offs.
Mm-hmm.
Persians.
Do you have a fella?
Ask me that one a little bit later.
These two aren't exactly nice, but they're endearing. Even the thugs and cops out to nail them admire their spunk. True Romance, written by Reservoir Dogs mastermind Quentin Tarantino, goes way over the top, over and over. The Marx Brothers stateroom scene is restaged with assault weapons, and the body count is impressive. But as the movie keeps insisting, in Hollywood people say, "I'll kill you," just trying to get your attention. In the end, True Romance is surprisingly sweet and funny, a violent date movie. It gets to that place between dreams and reality that other picture only talks about.
Kevin Whitehead usually reviews jazz for Fresh Air. Our show was produced today by Fred Landrell. Engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Chris Fraley, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscoane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of investment companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From the Fresh Air Archives, a talk with the great soul singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield, who was paralyzed 3 years ago in a freak stage accident. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.